Connected is on the air this Sunday evening. Hope everyone out there has had a great weekend. I'm Jamie, and Jerry's here with us, too.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, buddy.
That's all right. That's okay. What was that like? You were kind of doing like a cross between Schwarzenegger and Dracula there at
intro. That's my Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, okay.
Which is
that
a cross between Schwarzenegger and Dracula. That's exactly it.
Okay. All right. I'm just stating, you know, what it sounded like through the phone here. All right. Now, that's cool. That's good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's been going on?
Not much. It's been a week. Not a lot, you know, the same old, same old. So I guess we're going to, you know, we have Dolphin Tale tonight and that documentary, which really looks fascinating. But let's talk about Moneyball.
I think so, too. You know, the weekend box office, I mean, Moneyball was beaten by a 17-year-old film.
Mm-hmm.
But really, in The Lion King. But really, it wasn't. I mean, The Lion King was a phenomenon 17
right.
years ago. It's a Disney film. It's a family general audience film.
Right.
So it's no surprise to me that it's been a success in its re-release in 3D, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the top three were very close together, The Lion
mm-hmm.
King, Moneyball, and Dolphin Tale, right?
Yeah, especially between Moneyball and Dolphin Tale. That could have gone either way. And then everything else is, starting with Abduction, is a distant, distant fourth place.
Right.
And I hope that Taylor Lautner will – I hope that he's made a lot of money from those Twilight films.
It looks like it's competently done. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I just saw the trailer. But I know why Taylor Lautner was cast in it. It just seems like he is a – lightweight, even for the demands of that kind of role.
Yeah, I would. That's what it looks like. I think Kristen Stewart will have a very long life of everyone
yeah.
associated with that. I think she proved that before those films. She's proved it during, and I think she will have a very long.
She's a risk taker.
Yeah.
She really is. Yeah, I like her a lot, and
mm-hmm.
I know there are people that think that all she does is pout, but. Look at her choices, and look
yeah.
how brave she is with her choices.
Mm-hmm.
Whether Twilight affords her those opportunities or not, maybe they do, but
mm-hmm.
She's playing her career right, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really, you know, she's doing it right. I actually think, you know, given this something like Water for Elephants, I think Roger Pattinson could definitely, if he makes smart choices.
Yeah.
But look, let me give him the benefit of the doubt. Hayden Christensen is still making movies. Okay, and I mean, regardless of what they, you know, some of them aren't, you know, obviously most of them are, you know, are very run of the mill, but he is still, you know, there's a whole argument, would he not be making movies after the last Star Wars film? He's actually made, some interesting films, to be honest.
None more so than Shattered Glass.
Yeah, Shattered Glass, and then the other one where he played the, they couldn't call him Bob Dylan, they called him The Rocker, but in Factory Girl. I mean, it's interesting. So I think if he can, I thought he was very good in Water for Elephants. Remember Me, not so much, but that was just a bad movie. But I think.
Well,
he could take a cue
from Kristen Stewart. And I mean,
yeah.
I really like the God, why can't I remember the name of the movie? But the one that Kasdan directed with Gandolfini.
Welcome. Oh, what was it? Welcome to Riley's, yeah. That was a good one. Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, I like that film. I like that movie. So Moneyball. I gave my opinion on it. I love it. It's in one of my tops of the year, personally.
It's pretty close to perfect, I think. I think what we are witnessing this year is the fruits of Brad Pitt's labor over the last 20 years to really, I mean, regardless of what you think about Tree of Life, I'm not its biggest fan, but I like his performance. I just like Brad Pitt. He is someone that you're early on programmed to hate because he's a pretty boy, but he has made some of the wildest, best choices in a career. I mean, he really hit it out of the park, I think, with like things like True Romance and 12 Monkeys and 7. Then he went through the big thing of, you know, making a lot of films that, were hit and miss, and then he really cements himself in one of the most important roles of all time, Tyler Durden, Edward Norton's imaginary friend in Fight Club, or however you want to view that. Starting with Fight Club, we begin to really see Brad Pitt, And he takes, and I think every role after that, he takes chances, whether it's Snatch or Babel, or, and especially the Assassination of Jesse James. He's just this, and then he likes to have fun, too, the Ocean's 11 films. He is just, something, you know, he's not a young Robert Redford. In fact, he's much better than that.
I think so, too. I think he's better, yeah.
Much more courageous. But
I never necessarily saw Redford as versatile, and I see that Pitt is capable of a lot more colors than
Redford. Yeah, just but looking at Tree of Life in this film, they're such different roles, but they're also such vulnerable performances. And I just thought this is, like, an awesome film. It just works. It works very well. And it's also very, as a lot of the good, great sports movies, although it's more than a sports movie, it's very inspiring. It's come at a time when the country could use this. This is a guy who's really, you know, his backstory, the way that's told, never panned out. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of shame, and there's a lot of, you know, his baseball career really just never took off. And you see that in just his mannerisms and everything as he's talking in the present time of the story, where he's talking to Jonah Hill. And that scene, that first scene between him and Jonah Hill is classic.
Great. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
He goes, who are you? You know, exactly.
Over and over again. Yes. And then they meet in the garage and talk secretly about baseball statistics as if it's like the Deep Throat meeting and all the president's men, you know? Yeah.
It's just a fantastic film. I mean, I thought Jonah Hill was good. I thought, even for the small part, I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman was very good. I didn't even know he was in the film until like a couple of weeks ago. But I mean, I liked his character. I liked
He's barely in it, but that character, I mean, he makes it feel lived in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost apropos that he's barely in it because he just kind of fits in the wallpaper. You know?
Right.
He's just there. You know, he's the baseball coach. And he was really kind of insignificant to the whole direction of the team anyway. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just a fascinating film, and you know, he really believes. Both of them believe in this. They believe in this whole thing, and it's not, for the most part, it's not working out for them. And then I like also the other thing that they talk to the players and everything and tell them what they can do to improve things. And I just thought it was very, and especially, I mean, I'm not the biggest baseball fan in the world, but I just thought it was just so engrossing, so fascinating to watch unfold.
Well, because it's one of the best screenplays of the year. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Steven Zaillian and Aaron Sorkin wrote it, and I could tell that Zaillian probably structured the thing, and Sorkin came in to punch up dialogue. I think
mm-hmm.
that's probably what happened with the script. But every character's great. It's very funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's very honest. It has a good pace. Now, it doesn't have your typical rah-rah sports ending, and I thought about that.
I thought about that
in the end.
Yeah.
When I walked out of it, I said, well, first of all, you can't kind of alter reality. But in another way, too, it is a victory for him.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people I know will walk out, as my friend did, and he said, you know, I would have taken that job, $12.5 million. You can provide for your daughter a lot better.
Right.
But the reality is they set that up very well because they have that scene earlier where he says, it's not about money to me. I want to change the game.
Right.
And in that respect, he was a success. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he accomplished his dream.
Mm-hmm. He did.
Yeah.
It's just utterly fascinating, though. And it does. I mean, I really, Sorkin is someone who can come in. We see this as The Social Network. We see this as other things. And he really can, through dialogue, can make anything interesting, I've decided. He could make a faculty meeting exciting for the screen, I think, or, you know, an investor's meeting. I think he has it. There's just something about him that it just
Well, that's good,
through.
Because his next film is called PTA.
PTA, there you go. I mean, that will be awesome. But no, it is an incredible, really, I think, an incredible achievement.
And one of the best, most charming, as I said before, movie star performances I've seen in years. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's what a movie star does for you right there, that movie, Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So good movie. I hope it has legs. I know it'll have Oscar. I know it'll have Oscar love, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will.
I think, yeah.
Now, you didn't go
so.
Back and see Lion King in 3D, did you?
No, I'm not a big, you know, Toy Story is for me the first Disney film I get really excited about. I like The Lion King, but it's not something I'm going to, come on, 3D? What do I need to see in 3D? Really? Really? I need to go back and watch that in 3D? I'm not going to go back and watch The Phantom Menace in 3D. I'm not going to go back and watch The Lion King in 3D, okay?
Are you not going to go back and watch that in 3D? Really?
I'm
going to go to the theater
rather,
to watch it?
I'd just rather slit my throat. About The Phantom Menace?
That belongs on the poster, let me tell you.
No, can I tell you about The Phantom Menace? Can I just be honest? But forget everything else. Forget Jar Jar Binks. Forget the Jake Lloyd character. You know what The Phantom Menace's greatest crime is? It's boring.
Yeah.
And forget all the stuff. Even forget that. The movie is one of the worst-paced movies. A movie like that, that's my whole beef, really, with the prequels. Forget all the stupid stuff. It's just a poorly paced movie. It's just boring. I mean, we say, what if all gotten killed on Tatooine? Then, you know? I mean,
and, you know, I rewatched a lot of Avatar today because it was just happened to be on cable. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a movie that it has kind of a classic structure.
Mm-hmm.
The movie's weakness is obviously the screenplay, but it pays enough attention to the other elements other than the technical to be a success. The new Star Wars trilogy does not.
Yeah, I think the third one, he finally woke up to that fact and made it.
Yeah.
But even, let's be very honest, the second and third one, though, there are elements that I don't think, if Phantom Menace had been good and done well, there's a lot of, how should we say it, fanboy wish fulfillment in the second one, and especially in the third one. And that's fine, but I don't think if Phantom Menace had gone the way I think he had wanted it to, those films might have been somewhat different. But I do like the third one. I won't lie to you. I like the third one, but he is so obsessed with the technology lately. I mean, I don't know. Like you said, he's a good idea, man. We've said that, but he just needs someone else, I think, to flesh it out.
Yeah. Well, so the big question is, people have been really disheartened by the changes that have been made to Star Wars Blu-ray, where he's altered things and he's put in, you know,
obviously
really
not, as you pointed out.
Cheesy ending. I'm about to point it out.
Yeah.
So, with all this fan protest, are they going to stand up? Are they going to make a statement that they won't stand for it? No. Here's what happened. Here's a breaking news update. It's the biggest Blu-ray release of all time in 1 week.
And does that really surprise anybody? I mean,
way to go, guys.
I mean, Jesus.
So, why does Lucas do it? Because he can. Because people will buy it, whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, he just doesn't, you don't, and I mean, I think, I, you know, if you bought it, cool. I haven't bought it. I just don't have this, you know, extra money. I would be very curious to see what he's done. But I feel like I have this series of films on so many different media. I mean,
yeah.
And what's really funny, though, is we know that there's going to be a 3D thing in a couple of years anyway. So
you're
going to have to shell out again, guys. So
I'd be interested in seeing the quality of it. I'd be interested in seeing the 4 hours of extras in it that I haven't seen before.
Oh, yeah, I definitely would check that out. I just don't have the extra money right now to really put out for that.
Yeah,
so
that's true. All right, Dolphin Tale also came out this weekend. It opened third place, just shaving Moneyball's lead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great family film. Morgan Freeman, Ashley Judd, Harry Connick Jr. It's a true story about a dolphin that lost its tail. Dolphin's name is Winter. And through rehabilitation and a prosthetic tail, they kind of brought it back to life and functioning again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story that actually takes place in my neck of the woods in Clearwater. Something like a half hour away from me. It was shot here, too. They had the big premiere last Wednesday, and they had a power outage during the premiere.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but, I mean, the movie and the story means a lot to the community. So Charles Martin Smith, he is the director of the film. He did a lot of rewriting on the film as well, uncredited, and he's a lot of people know him as an actor. He's one of the most prolific character actors. He was in American Graffiti, speaking of George Lucas. He was in Starman.
The
Untouchables. Yeah, he was like the accountant in The Untouchables, right?
Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It just amassed a great body of work with many terrific directors, including Carol Ballard, Never Cry Wolf, too. And that's an important reference point for Dolphin Tale. His other directorial efforts, Trick or Treat.
That's right. Yeah, okay. Oh, my God.
And Air Bud. I mean, talk about a 180.
Yeah. Air Bud, there you go.
I mean, it's true. I mean, come on.
No.
So he now of course he has Dolphin Tale, and it's already been successful in the theaters. And we spoke to him last week and started the conversation talking about his premiere in Clearwater on Wednesday. Here's Charles Martin Smith.
I want you to custom make some parts for me. Not like anything we've done before. May not work, and I can't pay you.
Other than that, I should be excited, right?
Who's the patient?
No dolphin has ever been known to lose its entire tail and survive.
We can't make her want to live. She's going to have to do that part on her own.
Dad, she's the boy from the beach, remember? Oh, she's going to live if she can't swim.
You had your premiere last night there, didn't you? How did that go?
Oh, yeah, we did. It was great. It was crazy. It was really an event, and there were so many people there that had worked on the film and been around it. It was kind of an easy audience, to say the least. They were all very enthusiastic, which was fine.
And we had a power outage in the middle of it. So we had
an unplanned intermission of about, about 45 minutes. But it kind of added to the party atmosphere, so it was actually really nice.
What does it mean to them? I mean, everyone in that community and in the Marine Aquarium there, what does this movie represent to them, do you think?
Well, I think it represents a lot of different things. I mean, you know, pride in the community and pride in that Marine Hospital and the work that they're doing there, you know. They're really doing wonderful work, you know. I tried to emphasize that in the movie, rescue, rehab, and release, and the idea that these animals should be and are released into the wild whenever possible.
Now, I know that this project had been around for many years. It had been tinkered with when it got into your hands. When you took over the project, what was the direction, the different kind of direction that you wanted to take it?
Well, I think, you know, they had been working on scripts. They'd had a couple of different writers in there. And I think, you know, people weren't really happy with where it was going. And I kind of took it back to the basics. I just wanted to make it a story about, you know, the boy and the dolphin and keep it very simple. Her journey and what she went through, to me, was so profound and so emotional and so simple that I think, you know, they'd gotten sort of very complex. They'd gotten a bit, the idea of the character of Kyle, the soldier, was great. But I think the movie had gotten off on the wrong track, sort of doing more of that. So I actually came in and did quite a lot of writing, basically rewrote the movie. Two writers who were there before me are the ones credited. But I really tried to simplify it and make it the simple emotional story of what she went through. And I think that helped a lot.
You've had a lot of success with films that are suitable and geared toward the entire family. And is there a formula for making a successful family picture?
That's a good question. I don't think so. Although I think there are certain basic principles of storytelling that are always, you know, important. You want to, you know, take the characters through an emotional journey. And I think you want to keep things simple with a kid's film. Simple, but basic, you know.
Right.
You know, you hate to use the old cliche, but, you know, boy meets dolphin, boy loses dolphin, boy gets dolphin back. I mean, it's kind of, there are sort of basic classic storytelling things, which I think work very well. They do in literature, and they do in film as well.
Yeah.
And also, I think the idea was something, and I really do enjoy doing stories that, you know, sort of have an element of man versus nature or... you know, what happens when man and nature collide. And they're very visual. And I think one of the important things to remember with a film like this is to try to tell the story in as visual a way as possible.
And I think also something that characterizes this film, and another successful family fair is that it doesn't condescend to the younger audience. It's truthful.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's great. That is the nicest thing you could say. I love kids. I find them interesting, fascinating. They're very bright, and they understand so much. And I don't like the idea of a film that talks down to them, and I never would do that. In fact, this film, of course, is not really designed exactly for children. It's really for everyone. But I think when it comes to kids in the audience, you don't want to talk down to them. They really do understand so much, and they want to learn. They want to catch up, you know. So
yeah.
I think the thing is just to tell the thing as honestly as possible.
Well, what's also something that struck me when I saw the movie is thinking about your role as director. You know, you're dealing with terrific child actors. You're dealing with a dolphin. You're dealing
right.
with some of the great actors that we have, Morgan Freeman, Ashley Judd, Harry Connick. I would think that the biggest challenge for you would be to accommodate each of their individual needs and kind of set a tone where all of those elements can feel free to create.
Well, yeah, I mean, that really was, an issue. And I love working with kids, young actors. I love working with inexperienced actors because having been an actor myself for so long, I can kind of, you know, be a bit of an acting coach and teacher along with the directing. But of course, you know, obviously Ashley and Harry and Morgan don't need that. So for me, it was trying to take different approaches with the different actors and make sure that everybody was in the same movie and, you know, sort of on the same page. One of the things, by the way, that made that easy on this film was that Nathan Gamble and Cozy Zuhlsdorf, the two kids, are so good. They're really, really talented and very, very skilled actors. I could almost approach them like I would an adult actor, and that's amazing. They're really gifted kids.
Did they have a chance to kind of get together prior to shooting and spend time together and get a kind of chemistry going before the cameras started rolling?
A little bit. Actually, I auditioned hundreds of kids, I think, and, you know, spent a couple of months looking for the actors for the film. And we had the very final screen tests. I put the two of them together. That was my sort of grand finale to the screen test, and did about three or four scenes with them, thinking that these were probably going to be the two, and we did it there at the Alcon offices, and my producers, Andrew and Broderick and Richard Ingber, Steve Wegner, were all there, and we all agreed that these kids were both so gifted, so good, and immediately had chemistry. And actually, Cozy told me later that after the audition, of course, neither of them knew they had the part. As they were leaving, they were each saying to each other, "I hope you get the part. Oh, no, I hope you get the part. I hope you get the part." They're so supportive of each other and really, really sweet kids.
And that's when you know that you've hit the gold mine, too, because you could find an actor that can be perfect for a role, but that doesn't mean that they'll be perfect with their co-stars. That's that undefinable chemistry, yeah.
That's exactly right. And you know what the final thing I had to do? We couldn't actually offer Nathan the part officially until we brought him to Clearwater and put him in the water with Winter, because if for some reason Winter didn't like him, I mean, you know, and dolphins are very bright and they have their own opinions, or if he, as a 12-year-old boy, was afraid of this 250-pound wild animal, we wouldn't have a movie. So we had to make sure that he and Winter were okay before we could actually finalize the deal with him. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Kind of like Winter had, you know, ultimate approval of who was going to play the boy. And, you know, she got along. She loved him. She thought he was great. And he thought she was great. As you can see in the movie, they really get along well. And so anyway, but it was pretty funny. We're thinking, yeah, the ultimate casting chemistry decisions is a boy and a, you know, marine mammal.
Well, as it should be for this project. Yeah, that's perfect. But you, I mean, tell me about shooting with Winter. I mean, it had to have been, the production had to have kind of been tailored around Winter's needs more than anyone else's.
Yes, it really was. I mean, my statement to everybody when we first got started is that, to me, the most important thing is Winter's well-being. I mean, we're making a movie, but this is her life. So I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that we would work around her schedule, and if, you know, if there were a day, she's a young dolphin. She's not a fully grown animal, you know. She's still the equivalent of maybe a human 10-year-old when we were shooting. So, and I kept telling her, listen, I kept telling everybody, listen, if she doesn't feel like working, we have to shoot something else. I had a wonderful first AD and producer who were able to change the schedule and shift things around, and that's what we did. If Winter didn't feel like working, then we wouldn't work on her scenes. We'd immediately jump into something else. You know, she's not a trained animal. She's a wild animal who has grown up in captivity because of her injury, but she still is. She's not a trained, you know, circus animal that you can have do certain things at certain times.
Right.
We treated her. She was the most important thing on set. Her well-being.
Well, you've had as an actor, I would think that it would be such a kind of a fertile training ground to go into directing, because you've worked with some of the best. I mean, from the ingenuity of a Lucas to the visual innovation of a De Palma. I mean,
Well,
many of the great directors.
My own sort of personal, you know, mentor, if I can say it that way, is Carol Ballard, who is so beautifully visual, you know. I sat the cinematographer down before we started this and showed him Black Stallion and said, here's how you do, you know, wild animals and here's what, you know, beautiful sort of visual example of this sort of, maybe this genre, if you'll call it that. But, yeah, no, I've worked with a lot of really terrific people. But, you know, I was a directing student at university. When I went to university, I studied acting, but I also got interested in directing, and I thought that my career would be in theater. I was hoping that maybe I could get into theater and be a director that way, which I somehow got sidetracked into movies along the line. But
as a longtime actor who is directing, what's the one thing that you know as an actor that how do I ask this question? This gets confusing even to me. As a director, what's the one most valuable lesson that you can impart about actors and their needs from a director, having been one yourself?
I think maybe I'm only speaking from my own personal bias, but I think it really helps a director to try it, you know? Be in the actor's shoes and see what they're up against and see how they work. For me, luckily, having been an actor for so many years, I understand various different approaches, and every actor approaches it a little bit different. So I go to the actors at the beginning and try to get a sense of how they approach the work so that I can help them in different ways. You know, you talk to one actor differently than you would talk to another. Certainly I direct, you know, Nathan and Cozy differently than I would direct Morgan. So I think, but I think it's having been an actor myself that helps. And I think in a lot of ways, a good thing for a director to do would be to take a few acting classes.
Yeah.
You know, see what these people have to go through. It's very daunting to be an actor. You're up in front of everybody and they're all staring at you. You're waiting around all day and then suddenly, you know, the entire pressure is on you. And
to kind of establish an atmosphere where in spite of all that, they don't feel self-conscious.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. You have to give them a comfort zone where they can make mistakes and they can be bad. If an actor feels like he can never be bad, then he'll never take the chance to be good. And I think that's a very important thing for any director to remember, is that you need to give an actor a safe place to work, and then they'll do good work.
Well, when you have an actor with the kind of simplicity and grace of a Morgan Freeman in front of your lens,
yeah,
I mean, do you just try your best to stay out of his way, or what is that element like?
No, actually, I don't. It's, no matter how good or experienced, he's a consummate actor. I mean, he's amazing. He still needs guidance. He needs an outside eye to help point sort of one way or another way. And, to be within the film. He's not the one who's making the movie, so he doesn't exactly understand what I'm getting at all the time. And actors, the best actors want direction, and they need it. And, you do it respectfully, and of course, with him, it's like, I don't know, it's like, I don't know, you're guiding such a seasoned professional and such a, you know, sort of a consummate actor that you don't need to say much, but even an actor like that, I think even, you know, Laurence Olivier wanted the director to tell him a little bit, you know, go a little left, go a little that, a little more of this, a little less of that, and they appreciate it.
And I would think that would be something that they crave, and a lot of directors, I'm sure, are probably sheepish to actually offer them direction just because they're intimidated.
Well, it could be actually, and I think that actors like that are sometimes intimidating to directors. And I think it helps me that I've been an actor myself for so long that they understand that I understand them.
What was the 3D filmmaking experience like? Was that any different from shooting regular?
Yeah, it was. I mean, one of the issues just simply was that the cameras are so big and heavy and kind of lumpy, these big 3D rigs, that it was very difficult to move them around. I normally like to move the camera more than I was able to on this film. But I liked the idea of it because I felt like we could use it to draw the audience into the frame, into the movie, and get them into as if they were underwater swimming with winter themselves. That was the main goal, I think, for me with the 3D. I thought, you know, Cameron did it really well in Avatar. He didn't really use it as a gimmick as much as he just did to give it more depth and to make you feel like you're on that other planet. In a way, when you're underwater on this planet, it's like another planet. It's very much like another world.
So the last question I want to know from you is, I'm always curious, this is your baby, this film, and you're going to unleash it to the world tomorrow. So what feelings are you experiencing right now?
Oh, well, I don't know. It's exactly like that. You do the best you can, and you turn it loose and hope people like it, you know? I guess I'm a little nervous about it, but on the other hand, it's ready to be unleashed on an unsuspecting world. I'm all right with that, and I just hope people go and enjoy themselves, you know? I mean, there are some lovely, I think, messages and things people can take away from this movie, but I also just want them to have a good time. You want to come to the theater, just enjoy it. And then if you leave with something you could think about, that's wonderful. That's what I strive for.
Every aquarium in the country says it's hopeless.
Well, they haven't met winter yet.
Okay, that is actor and director Charles Martin Smith. His new film is Dolphin Tale. It's out in theaters now, so go see it.
Sounds good, man. That was a good interview. Fascinating.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he is. Very nice.
So we were talking about Lion King earlier. You know, Lion King is now, with this re-release, it's the third highest-grossing animated film in history. What are the first two?
Oh God!
I don't have like a Jeopardy.
Theme. I mean,
let me play. Let me play this. This will be our Jeopardy theme. Go ahead.
Thankfully, I don't know. I'm glad I don't know that. So tell me.
All right. It is. They are. First place is Toy Story.
Okay.
Second place is Shrek 2.
Shrek 2, really? Shrek 2. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Wow.
There you go.
Shrek 2. Well, I guess it's not better than Shrek 4, I guess, or Shrek 65, or how many ever there are.
I did see Shrek 4 a couple weeks ago, because I hadn't seen it yet.
It's the one that's like It's a Wonderful Life, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an improvement over Shrek 3. Shrek 3 was just blah. It was dull.
So is bowel cancer, from what I've heard. So, you know.
Get another pull quote for a movie poster for
Shrek. I'm sorry. No, those films took really. I mean, the second one's okay, but the third one, you know, they really run that into the ground. So
yeah,
I mean, it is very sad because the first one is a really clever, inventive film.
Yeah, I think so too. And speaking of family movies, for the past 7 weekends in a row, what has been the number one movie internationally?
I bet the Smurfs.
Yes. 7 weeks in a row.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would never have thought that. I would never have thought that when they first announced they were making that in a movie. Just like, that's one of those movies where you just roll your eyes. And but I get, you know, people are responding to it.
Obviously wildly successful, that movie.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be a Smurfs, too.
Yeah, yeah. This summer, get Smurfed. That's, yeah. The blue guys are making lots of green. Making lots of green.
Yeah, they are.
Which, what is that? What color does that make? Yellow? What does that make?
Isn't
blue
that,
and
wait,
green.
Wait, I think, yeah. I mean.
I can't believe this.
I can't believe we're having this conversation.
Yeah. All of a sudden,
I feel like I'm in elementary art school, art class, first grade art class.
Hey, did you see the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trailer, the extended?
Wow, that is something. I mean, I just can't wait. I'm so excited for that.
Yeah.
I just
let me bring Dean on. Let's talk about this if he's seen it. Dean, have you seen the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trailer?
I haven't actually. I'm not so excited about that movie, so I'm like.
So you refuse to even watch the trailer?
I watched the first one. That was enough for me.
It's a 4-minute.
Hey, I know, 4 minutes, man.
That's a little
it
too
runs
long, too.
It runs it, down the entire story.
I don't want to see it. I'd much rather just stay away from seeing too much of it.
Did you see the original?
No, I haven't. I don't know anything about the entire story or anything. So I'm going, when I finally do see the movie, I'll be going into it completely, this will be the original to me.
Okay, well, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, I just don't want to see anything from it. I don't really know what it's about or, you know, anything. So I've kind of stayed away from it.
Okay, that's a good policy. I mean,
yeah.
Well, it's a good story, and it requires a strong storyteller behind the camera, and that's what Fincher has really become with Zodiac and Social Network, and you know, so I think it's up his alley.
I think so too. I think it has the potential to be one of those cases where it will be on par, if not better, with the original. I love the original trilogy of the foreign language films. I think they're incredible. I think the big challenge with this film is everyone's spot on. Is it's going to be Rooney Mara.
Mm-hmm.
And how does she stack up to the original? That's really going to be the big thing.
She just signed on for something. Oh, no. It was announced that Warren Beatty, his Howard Hughes pick, Paramount dropped it. So it has gone to New Regency, which I think is a Warner Brothers company.
Okay.
So he's in, now he's legendary for being the most persnickety, challenging director out there. So maybe Paramount just lost their marbles with him just in the pre-production phase. Maybe. But Rooney Mara is in contention for the lead in that movie. And it's Beatty would play Howard Hughes. It's a fictional take on the latter years of his life. And Rooney Mara would play a younger woman that he hooks up with.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
Speaking
Warren Beatty
of Howard,
as Howard Hughes in every sense of the word.
Yeah. So speaking of Howard Hughes, has anyone seen this trailer for J. Edgar yet?
Now that I did see.
Doesn't it look like Nixon meets the Aviator, essentially, the tone?
I think it looks really boring. I have to be honest. It looks really dull to me.
It's just,
like one of those sleepy Sunday afternoon movies that you'll catch on TV, like, you know, 10 years from now or something. I'm not excited by it at all.
I don't know what to make of it. I mean, it really looked like it took from that, and I love Eastwood and everything, but I was like, all right, what would happen if you put Nixon in the Aviator in a blender? Let's see what we get. And that's what it looks like, tone-wise, at least.
When you see him, it's a mistake to show us scenes with him, like, sitting behind that table with the microphone in front of him, with the big crowd behind him, you know, and the that Congress is in front of him or whatever, you know. So it's like, it's such a mistake because, you know, everybody's seen The Aviator. We've already seen him do these kind of scenes.
Yeah.
About the only thing that really got me sort of like interested, but maybe not in a good way, was just seeing the quick shots of him in old age makeup as J. Edgar Hoover in his later years or whatever, because you've never seen, I don't think we've ever seen DiCaprio in any kind of like major makeup prosthesis or anything like that, so it'll be interesting to see how he deals with that.
But it's definitely the kind of role that can get him a nomination.
Oh, well, I think, I mean, unless it's really like just derails itself, I think he is a shoo-in. I think as of right now, but it just kind of, the whole thing with the Judi Dench's mother and everything reminded me so much of Mary Steenburgen as Nixon's mother in Nixon.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't get that out of my head as soon as I saw the show on Friday.
Yeah, you're right about that. But also the thing with the mother that pops up right at the beginning of the trailer, I mean, maybe this is a poor reflection on me, but right away it was apparent that they were playing J. Edgar as a gay man. Because of his, the first sight is like the undying devotion to the mother. Now, Dustin Lance Black wrote this script. I'd be interested to know how much it plays up the homosexuality, because, I mean, obviously Hoover is
like
a fascinating.
I like Hoover better. I like Hoover.
Yeah, it's like Kluger from that horror movie. What was that? Last House on the Left. But Hoover was a fascinating figure because obviously he was behind some of the great politics and politicians of the time, and he really changed the course of a lot of things in very kind of questionable ways.
Right.
But for someone that was so deeply invested in scandal and getting dirt on people and blah, 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 he led a very secret life as a gay man. And part of it was the period in which he was living. And part of it was because of his personality, he couldn't really run the risk of having that go public. But how much does the movie play that up? You would think with Dustin Lance Black writing it, it would play it up. And the central relationship between the two men, J. Edgar and the other character, would seem to indicate that. At the same time, Eastwood says, it's not about that. Like Eastwood wouldn't be the person that you would expect to explore those kinds of themes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know. It was just such an odd thing. Not an odd thing to make a biopic, but how are you? I'm curious. I'm very curious to see it, but I just it's been, you know, you do have these other films that have dealt over in ways.
I mean, Dustin Lance Black, the original title of the script was Brokeback Hoover. But then Eastwood came in and changed it to J. Edgar, so that tells you right there. That's not true.
Brokeback Hoover.
It was kind of funny.
That was funny. I like it. Everything, but it's better not to get your hopes up on a lot of Eastwood movies because
I feel that way too, yeah.
Because I really think that he hits it about one in three times, maybe.
But when he does hit it, it's pretty impressive, though, when he does.
No doubt. No question about it. So.
And the thing I admire most about him is that in this very late stage in his career, he's taking more risks than he ever has.
Mm-hmm.
I find that very impressive, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Why has Drive not been very successful with audiences?
Oh, yeah, what number was that this weekend? That's a good question.
I don't know why.
One of the best, it's like with Warrior. You know, you have these two really good movies that are just not catching on. But Drive has everything.
It's my theory that if people sense that something is going to be good, they stay away from it in droves.
Really?
Yeah.
Dean has a very good point here, actually.
I totally believe that if the movie-going public senses that the critics or a movie is getting critical praise, mm-hmm. that's the movie that they're not going to go see because they just they hate critics so much that they don't even want to see it.
You think they hate? It's not that they hate critics so much. They just don't. A majority of people. I wouldn't say majority, but a lot of people just don't read film reviews, and
right.
And they don't want to be challenged too much when they.
I don't even know. I think you are giving people way too much credit. I think you're giving reviews way too much power that they don't have. I think what it is we live now. We live in a time where there's so many different venues for home entertainment or entertainment in general. That it is, the movies are having a hard time, and the really good ones, some of them. Now, let's take a now about the good reviews. Look, Rise of the Planet of the Apes got terrific reviews. Now, a year ago, I would not have expected that. People went out and saw that. That was a word-of-mouth movie and a review that people went out and checked out. You know, there are a couple of big films like that that work this year, but then you have smaller films that got really good, you know, reviews, but the smaller films don't stand a chance in this marketplace. But the one exception would be Midnight in Paris. That did a phenomenal.
I mean, The Help isn't like.
The Help.
The Help got great reviews too, pretty much. So.
And then people went in droves to see that. I mean,
it's not a hard and fast rule, but it's just the kind of thing. It's like for the most part, I just think that people, you know, make a decision that they just don't feel like being challenged by a lot of movies. You know, The Help and all these movies that we mentioned, The Help and Rise of the Planet of the Apes, these are not challenging movies.
No, they're not challenging movies, but...
And I don't think that people want to be, you know...
Can I add something?
I don't necessarily think that people would see the trailer or anything from Drive and think that it's a challenging movie.
Yeah, I don't know if challenge is not the right word, but I got to also say something, and we really have not – we addressed this early on. But we're living through a really, really horrific time right now. People don't have the discretionary income to go to the movie. So they are going to pick the safe bet. Because you got to remember, Dean, a family or like a date or something, you get the – first of all, the ticket prices are enough are expensive. But then there's the concession stand. Holy shit. I mean, come on. I can fund if I worked to own a theater, I could fund, you know, I could buy a Lamborghini in 2 months. But you know, that you've gotta take that into consideration. And it's just something that doing this show and people don't, you know, they're not gonna go see maybe something like Drive or even something. I'm surprised Warrior I'm more surprised about. But they're just not. If they need to have people do like a safe bet, and in this climate, I can totally understand that. Because, it's scary out there.
Well, what do you mean by a safe bet? Do you mean
a safe bet in the conventional sense of,
do they want to see a good movie, or do they want to? I mean, because if you wanted
all,
to see
all,
a good
all,
movie,
that's
people
taste,
would
that's
be.
Taste. I mean, they're not going to. Let's just be very honest, Dean. They're not going to. All right. I don't think they're going to, given a choice between Tree of Life. And get with The Help. I think The Help is going to win out.
Well, so, I'm not surprised that Tree of Life didn't.
No, Tree of Life. I mean, come on. I mean, hey,
that's a difficult, very difficult movie.
But
by safe bet,
I mean just
we mean movies that they feel safe going to see that they know what
theater.
They're going to get.
A crowd pleaser.
They know what they're going to get before they walk into the theater. That's why. The Lion King is number one for 2 weeks. That's why The Smurfs is number one for 7 straight weekends.
And if you can take a family, that
could be why Planet of the Apes. I mean, Planet of the Apes is a known entity.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we're just living in a time where maybe it's more clear to say we're living in a time in which most people, in one way or another, are infantile. They're either their entertainment choices are controlled by the infants that they have in their family, you know, the 5-year-olds, whatever, or either that, or they have infantile taste.
I disagree. I would have agreed with you 10 years ago, 200%. As I've gotten older, Dean, I just don't agree with that anymore.
I do. I think that.
I don't.
I think that,
I don't see it. I mean, it's very easy to play that card. And trust me, 10 years ago, I would have been in your row in the dugout box with you, cheering you on, and I would have probably said something equally harsh like that. But I don't see it like that now. Going out to the movies for some, not everyone, is a luxury. It is a thing, you know, especially family, or at least if you're going with some buddies and they don't want, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. Transformers is going to win out. A known entity, a property, or something, you know, just something that just looks like a crowd pleaser is going to win out over some of the more serious fare. That's not to say I think that serious fare is very good, but it's just people, you know, when they go out, it's their money, it's their hard-earned money. I'm going to be honest with you, they want it, they don't, they're not, it ain't Vegas, they ain't going to risk it.
So you don't think so much that people are generally getting more stupid.
It's tempted to go in an idiocracy route, but who am I to say that?
Why you don't think that? I don't get it. You still haven't convinced me because you haven't. You said okay, well everybody wants a safe bet, but that's a kind of a term that requires some kind of like something behind it. You know, like what? Why do you think this is a safe bet? Why do you think that Transformers or Smurfs or Rise of the Planet of the Apes or The Help, why are these safe bets?
I don't know about The Help, but
The Help,
I mean,
is
the other three that you just mentioned,
but
they're movies that people know before they even go to see it.
They're known properties. It's why studios are willing to make them into movies. That's why, I mean, I'm not sure about the logic behind Battleship. Now, that I don't get at all. But I'm waiting for the Chutes and Ladders movie to come out. That's what I'm really looking for. But, no, I don't. I mean, 15, I would love to have played this game. I just have gotten older, and I've probably mellowed out. I'm probably seeing firsthand what this, you know, what this economic situation is doing to people. Including myself, and it's just, dude, there are people who are just going to be, and I talked to people about this even 10 years ago, about the Fast and the Furious. They'd much rather go see the Fast and Furious, which in itself is a fun movie and everything, as over Sexy Beast, which opened the same weekend. They're going to, and it's, this is nothing new, it's just that as I've gotten older, I understand that choice of more and more. And I'm not going to get on a soapbox and say, oh, you're all idiots for Sexy Beast, and that's your right to do that. I can't do that anymore in good faith.
But there is also the element that they don't necessarily want to be challenged. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, it could be as much an economic decision as a taste decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, they could see something like Drive and think, I don't want to see, not that they know this word, but it looks artsy-fartsy to me. It looks too kind of existential. I don't want to, I don't necessarily want to sit through that. I want to put my problems in the back seat and
I don't think people want to be reminded. I mean,
yeah.
But here's another thing. Another thing about Transformers and Pirates, and there's of all those movies, global phenomenons, the Harry Potter series is the one I do agree with 100%, and I think is, and it actually is a challenging film, because if you walked into that last one cold and hadn't seen the others, you would have probably blown your brains out. What the hell's going on? Who are these people?
Right.
But we now live in a new era, a very new era, is that films that are going to be made in this country really aren't going to be made for us so much for American audiences. They're made for a global marketplace now, and that's even, I find, a little bit depressing because basically it does have to be a known property to really get a green light.
Well, maybe that's just what, I mean, that's just like a bellwether of what's happening just in general, you know, the entire corporate world is forsaking, the entire American-run corporate world is forsaking America and going, and leaving America behind and going to conquer the world.
Yeah, I mean,
and so
yeah.
That's what's happening with movies as well. So.
Yeah.
I have a 7-minute clip that we did not play during our behind the scenes show.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And it's probably the most famous, one of the most famous clips of our history. But it's, I mean, it's Paul Schrader talking about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you want to hear it?
I thought we were trying to get off by 7:15, but okay.
We're going to close. Yeah. All right. Well, let me play some of this. This is
okay.
Paul Schrader talking about why he thinks movies are dead and what movies will continue to survive in the multiplex.
You know, movies simply do not have the place in our society that they did 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, they've been relatively marginalized. And that is just a product of changing times, but also, more importantly, changing media.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that we've touched on this the second time, let's go ahead and explore it.
Yeah, I'm dying to hear this.
Yeah, this is the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
Now everything comes in kind of waves. I mean, the new Hollywood, the Hollywood Renaissance, of which you were such a critical part in the 70s, do you think that we'll ever get to that place again, or do you think it's a point of no return that we're at?
No, that's gone. You know, what's interesting about the moment we find ourselves in now is that when I came into films, late 60s, it was a moment of crisis, but it was a crisis of content. People didn't know what movies were about. They realized they couldn't be about what they used to be about, but what were they about? And then people started making films about different things. You know, along came Easy Rider, along came Last Picture Show, and all of a sudden you realize that you can make films about these subjects. And it changed the American film industry. And it ushered in, actually, a very wonderful period of filmmaking. We're in a similar period of crisis now. Unfortunately, the nature of the crisis is not what movies are about, but what are movies. We no longer know what movies are. We don't know how long they are. We don't know where you watch them. You don't know whether you interact with them. You don't know whether they have narrative or not. I mean, and it's very exciting creatively, but movies are morphing into something else. And like yesterday, I went to the movies, and I saw The Bank Job, and I saw three movies. I saw Boleyn Girl, and then I saw Paranoid Park.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the last movie. I said, well, there's a movie that was made now. You know, that's sort of what's happening now.
Right.
And so we are trying to figure out what the movies are. The producer of the film before my last film, who had produced 10 films, has left the producing business and now has a website where he has contests and he makes 3-minute movies for cell phones. This is a guy with a whole string of credits.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's how big the paradigm shift we're facing is right now. And it is kind of fascinating. I just finished the script, and it had a lot of kind of sexual material. It was about three nights in the life of an escort and her driver. And I thought to myself, I was going to write it feature length, and I was going to write it R-rated, because that's the tradition I come from.
Right.
And I thought, wait a second, why am I making this R? There is no R anymore. You know, theaters are on their way out.
Right.
Why don't I just make it hardcore? Because that's what the material is. I mean, it's about a girl who goes into assignations all night long. But why don't you just write what's happening? And why does it have to be an hour and a half, 2 hours? Maybe it's 320 minutes. And so I wrote this script, and it ended up being 320 minutes, and it ended up being unrated. And I thought, well, we'll make it for $400,000, and and it's a very kind of cheap movie, and we'll set up a website, and we'll sell it on the web. So if that's happening to me, and God knows, you know, I'm an old fart, if that's what's going on in my head, you can imagine what's going on in the heads of people who are, you know, 40 years younger than I am.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about this influx of new media, but how movies as we have known them are kind of losing their identity.
Right.
But doesn't it open up a flood of new options, and do you sense that movies no longer matter? Is that part of what you're sensing?
Well, audiovisual entertainment is, you know, in our bloodstreams. And it is as hard as it is for someone of my generation to conceive of a movie being watched on a cell phone in 3-minute segments. That may be part of the new mix of what AV is. And maybe that word AV will start to be replace the word movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because movies we think of as a 2-hour experience you sit in the theater and watch in the dark.
Yeah.
And time is not on the side of the movies. But it will always be on the side of storytelling. And as storytelling has progressed now as an audiovisual medium.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse
well,
me.
I'm 34, and I dread the day that we're relegated to watching films on the cell phone.
Yes, so do I.
Absolutely with you.
But Mr. Schrader, do you think the theater-going experience will become obsolete?
No, but it will start to mirror more and more the theatrical experience. It will become more of an event.
You think it will be like the preview, basically, the movie, the going to the theater is almost going to be like just an incredibly expensive ad for the DVD?
Well, there won't be DVDs.
Oh, that's true. That's going to go, too.
Within 4 years, DVDs are gone. You know, you can put them right next to your CDs.
Oh, great. Okay. I'm losing money by the day here.
But we do see that today. We do see that today where people don't want to pluck down $15 for a film unless they're going to be wowed like they're at an amusement park.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been happening for
yeah,
you know, over 2 decades now.
Yeah.
And well, here's another interesting phenomenon. We're now creating a generation of young people who don't think they should pay for entertainment. Why
yeah.
should I pay
yeah.
for music?
Mm-hmm.
Music is in the air. Music is free. Music is file shared. It started with music. Now it's happening with pornography. The web is full of...
Well, didn't the pornography come first, though, the free? That came before the music.
No, not free pornography.
Oh, okay.
Pornography is now free. The web is full of watch me and my girlfriend websites.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so all of a sudden, now, well, we don't need to pay for music. We don't need to pay for porn. Why should we pay for movies?
And you can't stop that. Once that genie's out of the bottle, you're never going to be able to enforce that.
Yeah, and you can make music and you can make porn in your living room. It's
you can do
hard
anything.
Yeah.
I mean,
God knows I do both.
He brings up a good point there. It's something that is so true. There is a whole generation, and I see this every day, that doesn't believe they have to pay for anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another
big
problem. That's the big thing right there. You have a generation, and that catches like wildfire. They're going to raise their kids with that. Well, we didn't have to pay for it. Now, whether I don't know, it's like what I told Mr. Schrader, I don't know how you ever enforce that. I don't know how you ever really change it. You would have to basically, in one term, shut down the internet.
They are planning to do that. You know, they do have. A bill on, I don't know if it's, I think it's passed, where cable companies, if they sense that you're downloading too much.
Oh, yeah, Comcast can do that, yeah.
They can give you a warning,
mm-hmm.
and they give you 3 warnings, and then they won't shut you out of the internet completely, but they'll limit your access to certain sites that you're downloading from, and that's the way they're going to handle that. At least that's the way they're going to start doing it. So there is going to be a way to enforce, you know, people not downloading stuff. They'll find a way around it, though. You know, I mean, that's
everyone finds
is.
A way around it. But yeah, that's probably the biggest thing is the how piracy has just become like this worldwide epidemic, and I just don't know how you really ever kill that.
Yeah. Yeah, so there it is. Movies are dead, ladies and gentlemen. God bless. Good night.
Okay. All right, yes. No, but Dean, I see.
Well,
where
they
you're
definitely
coming
are
from.
A luxury too. I mean, it is ridiculous how much they're a luxury. You know,
and yet they're still the least expensive form.
It's still the least expensive form of entertainment, like compared to a concert or something.
True.
Yes.
That's not true, because they're the least expensive form of, I guess, entertainment going out to get
going
entertained.
Going out, yes.
Right,
but,
that's
but,
what I mean. Yeah.
But video games are really the least expensive form of entertainment, because you pay $30 for a video game and you get 500 hours of play out of it. So,
right.
You know, you do the per capita thing, you know, but when you look at, like, how much entertainment you get out of movies, well, you get 2.5 hours of entertainment. And sometimes it's irritating going out to the movies for many reasons we've talked about. And so you get 2.5 hours that may or may not be so entertaining for your $20-25.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like going out to a concert. You know, rarely do you go out to a concert and you're irritated by people around you talking and stuff and, you know, like that.
Right.
At least when you go out to a concert, you're going to get, you know, 2 hours of entertainment. You're going to get almost exactly what you hope for, you know.
I don't know, man. I went to a Barry Manilow concert one time, and there was a really inebriated chick standing next to me singing to every single song. That was kind of annoying.
you weren't not expecting people to sing along. I mean, that's what they do at concerts.
No, I mean, when you're drunkenly singing every lyric, I don't pay for a concert to hear the drunk chick beside me singing.
Okay, well, that was a bad concert experience. But most concerts that you've been to have been okay.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't really go. I mean, I've been to rock. I mean, I've been to, like, Springsteen and Prince and stuff. But I was, like, at an Elton John concert. Like, the only, like, drugs that I noticed around me was at an Elton John concert. Somebody, like, started smoking weed or something behind us. I was like, really? I said, this is like a crowd full of octogenarians. And, you know, maybe in the 70s, Elton John.
Maybe it was medical marijuana.
Yeah, for glaucoma, yes. All right. We got great shows coming up throughout the month of October. We've got actors like Michael Berryman's returning to the show, character actor Bill Cobbs, who you said was one of your favorites, Dean.
Yeah, I like him a lot. He's good.
Dennis Farina, Joel Schumacher, Robert Davi, the executive producer of The Dark Knight Rises. Got us packed October, and then the Shining show will be our not only our fifth episode of the Kubrick series, but also our de facto Halloween show.
That's the perfect way to do that.
Also, we've got I'm starting covering
New York Film Festival
next week.
So you're going.
You're
attending the movies next week.
Yeah, I'm starting Friday. I think I have tickets. I'm pretty sure I have tickets to the opening night of Carnage. So I will be seeing Carnage on Friday with all of those. I guess all of the principal actors and everything will be there.
I'll tell you who won't be there.
Yes, we know who won't be there. And then I guess next Saturday also at the Martin Scorsese, George Harrison movie.
Cool.
Those will be my first two movies that I see.
So
I guess I'll be reporting on those, you know, next Sunday or whatever.
Cool.
Awesome. Good stuff.
Good stuff throughout the month of October. Let's get to our next interview, then we'll close with our movie score of the week, and we'll get out of here by 7:30.
Okay, cool.
Okay. This is a great documentary. It's called Return to Dwight and Nile, The Crash of PSA Flight 182. That's a flight, actually, 33 years ago today that collided with a small plane while on their landing, and the plane crashed into a San Diego neighborhood and caused a lot of carnage, a lot of death. And our next filmmaker, Dave Frisina, he was actually a child, and he was watching the news reports and the magazines and newspapers recounting this tragic kind of event. And years later, he became a documentary filmmaker, and he decided he wanted to explore this further with the people that witnessed it, the people that lived through it, and how they're still dealing with it today. The documentary is available online through his website at returntodwightandnile.com. You can purchase it there, and it's highly recommended. Here is Dave talking about the film Return to Dwight and Niall?
Always had an interest in the filmmaking process, specifically screenwriting. I started out writing scripts when I was younger. Never really went anywhere with it. Then started experimenting with short films and video cameras and 16mm. And then just sort of that sort of went by the wayside. And then when I got older, I just kept wanting to go back into it. So I did, and the end result is Return of Dwight and Niall.
This was not just another news story. This was not just another Monday morning. This was true horror.
It's taken 30 years, but I think it's good. It'll probably just get better.
I remember watching this on TV when I was 11. I came home from school that morning, or that afternoon, I should say, and there it was on the TV live, and it has always stuck with me, watching the news footage of it, the newspaper articles, the magazines, everything. And I've always just had that image in my head of the plane with the wing on fire going down, and something I've always wanted to know more about, and was never able to find anything about it, even on like channels like the Discovery Channel. They usually do series on plane crashes, and they never did one on PSN-82.
So when did you realize that there was a movie there?
Well, when I started doing more research on it, I reached out to the people of San Diego through the internet. I posted messages on Craigslist, wanting to know if anybody wanted to talk about this, and I just got flooded with emails, and people started calling me, and I realized I had tapped into something. That this was a story that had to be told.
And a lot of them hadn't. Several of your subjects hadn't really discussed it at length before you gave them an opportunity to, right?
Correct. Yeah, most of the people I spoke with, I was the first person they've told their story to in 30 years. It was just an emotional, just horrific event for the people of San Diego. And I guess finally someone gave them a forum to finally talk about it, and which is the film. And people have now been able to move on and heal from this experience and sort of get that off their shoulders. It's been bothering a lot of people for many years.
Well, yeah, it does seem like it was a cathartic experience for them to be able to unload that and share their perspectives on it. So tell me about the process, because this is obviously a tragic event that they were all intimately involved in. When you're sitting across from them conducting an interview on camera, tell me about that process for you. Was that challenging for you?
It was. It was very challenging. It was. There were times where I felt like I was intruding, or I kept saying to myself, why are these people opening up to me? What is it about me that these people feel have the ability to talk about these horrific things that happened to them 30 years ago and have never been able to tell anybody else? And then I realized that this was really something special that I was doing, and I think these people recognized in me that I was the real thing. It was an honest attempt to record this as history, I guess. And it was very difficult to listen to their stories. They're heartbreaking. It deeply affected me. And I spent 2 weeks in San Diego filming the interviews, and when I left there, I was drained, absolutely drained. I just couldn't believe what I'd just gone through.
Was there a lot of convincing on your part to try to get them to participate, or was it fairly easy? They were ready to do it.
Yeah, for a few people, it was difficult because they really didn't want to relive it. But the more they realized how important it was and what my intentions were, they really you know, opened up and decided that yeah, you know, I think I could tell my story to you, and I feel, you know, they felt comfortable doing it, and it was just a great experience for everybody.
So, I mean, did they give you a sense of why they agreed to do it, what they wanted to come from this and from sharing their story?
They felt it was time. They felt that, you know, 30 years was a long time to be holding these emotions in, which is what many of them had been doing. Many of them didn't realize that there are other people out there who shared the same feelings, the same stories.
What interests me about documentary filmmaking is, and I ask this as of all of our documentary filmmakers that we have on, is that you start out the project maybe with one movie in mind, and just from the process of collecting interviews and footage and that sort of thing, you might end up with a different kind of movie altogether. So the movie that you ended up with, how was that different from your initial conception?
Oh, it's 180 degrees different. It was my original idea for this was to bring a husband and wife who were the first people to reach out to me. He was a Vietnam veteran, and he was one of the first people to arrive on the crash scene, and he said this was just more horrific than being in Vietnam, and him and his wife wanted to go return to the crash site, where the title comes from, Return to Dwight and Nile. They were the people I was going to bring back to Dwight and Nile, and relive those moments and sort of put closure to their life, but they had some tragedy happen in their family, and that all pretty much fell apart. So I had to come up with Plan B. But I kept the title. I kept the idea of people going back to the crash site to revisit it and to reflect and to put closure. And that's when I planned everything around the 30th anniversary, which was the September 25th, 2008. And word of mouth spread, and hundreds of people showed up to the crash site to remember what happened, and people meeting for the first time. So I took that idea of people going back to the crash site, reliving this after 30 years.
You know, what's, I guess, the kind of the underlying theme that's most profound about the movie is that when these tragic, random kind of events occur in our lives that we can't make sense of, I mean, there's no making sense of it, how do you overcome them or deal with them?
Yeah, you're right. It is a concept that's unthinkable. Nobody would ever want to go through this. Nobody could ever dream of having gone through this, and to be part of it. For these folks to have been part of this horrible event, and I guess you could call them survivors because they saw and heard and smelled things that no one should ever have to deal with, and now they've finally at a point in their life where they can put this all behind them and move on, it starts out as a tragic event, and then 30 years later they finally are able to deal with it.
When you showed your subjects the documentary for the first time, that had to have been nerve-wracking for you.
It truly was. I guess it's everyone, every filmmaker's worst nightmare, how people are going to react to your film in a negative way. But I handled it. I knew I had to handle this in a certain way. I knew it had to be different than what is normally produced about a subject like this. And I knew I had to be very careful and very selective as to what was shown, and I just knew I had to present it in an honest and meaningful way, and it's very heartfelt. It's very emotional. You really are drawn into these people's lives, and you want to just reach out and give them a hug. Someone commented, and because they're just, you can just see the pain in their face and hear it in their voice, and to be in a room with 400 people watching this on a big screen was quite an experience. and there wasn't a noise in the house. I mean, it was just dead silence throughout the whole film. And at the end of the film, it was just a roar of applause, and it was just an amazing moment.
And the footage that you have too, the news footage, was that hard to get?
No, the news, everything fell right into my lap. This was an extremely easy project to put together. People were very forthcoming with information, with photos, with old news footage that they had, or old home movies that they had, and it was just had everything I needed. But going back to the reaction of the audience, I forgot about this. Well, one thing that people did, because it's such a hard story to listen to and watch, it's a very, very sad story. There were moments of laughter in the audience, and
mm-hmm.
I was sort of taken aback by that at first. And why are people laughing at these particular moments? And mainly if you watch the film, there's two gentlemen, two firemen who are together, and they've been friends for years, and their interaction with each other, someone compared to as an old married couple. They talk over each other. They one talks more than the other, and people respond to that with laughter. And I guess in a story that's just filled with sadness and horrific things, you have to find some humor in it, and that's what people did. There were moments where people were laughing through it.
Well, that's those two are they're a big highlight of your film, because they witnessed the horrific event kind of firsthand in a way that many people did not that were involved, and they hadn't really discussed it in depth with each other before, and you feel that kind of that connection and that
right.
kind of confession from them.
Exactly, and that was one of the interviews that was very special, because you see that progress throughout the entire interview, that these two have been friends for years. They experienced this terrible thing together, and really have never spoken about it since until I sat them down and filmed them. And you know, there's revelations about each other that each one didn't know about, and it's just an amazing interview.
Do you have other ideas cooking? Can you not wait to get back on the filmmaking front?
Sure. My latest project, I'm almost done filming. It's another documentary. I'm almost done filming the interviews. Actually, I'm going to be in San Diego next week to film a couple of interviews for this story. It just, again, happens to have its origin in San Diego. It's about a young man from Massachusetts who became paralyzed 10 years ago, and he found this place out in San Diego that has a different approach to treating people with spinal cord injury. And he, after 3 or 4 years of being in this facility, he learned how to walk again.
Mm.
And it's an absolutely amazing experience. And he took that knowledge and that information with him back to Massachusetts and opened up his own facility, and is now doing the same for other people. He has around 40 clients, and he's training and teaching these people how to live their life outside of a wheelchair. It's an incredible story.
Mm. Is there a particular kind of story that you feel most drawn to? I mean, when you look at these two films,
I just am always drawn to human interest. With the plane crash, I've always wondered what the heck the people were thinking when they looked up and saw this thing happening in front of them over the skies of San Diego. I always wondered what they were thinking. Of course, what the people on the airplane were thinking when they were going down. And then with this new one, it's called Mile of Hope, the Dan Cummings story. I heard Dan being interviewed on the radio last summer, and I thought his story was amazing. It just touched me, and I said, well, this is something I could probably pursue. And I reached out to him. He loved the idea, and we're almost done with the interviews. And his story is just very impactful. It's an emotional, heartfelt story.
Well, and it also sounds like a tragic event that occurs in your life, and what do you do with that? I mean, how do you let that define you, and how do you overcome? I mean, that sounds like the basic theme of both films.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Turning tragedy into something hopeful.
Okay, the film is Return to Dwight and Nile. The director is Dave Racina. You can go to returntodwightandnile.com where you can purchase the DVD, and the DVD also has some extras on it, too, that I'm sure you'll get a lot out of. It's a good, really good documentary, and I highly recommend it.
That was a great interview. This new film sounds fascinating, too.
Yeah. I love documentaries.
They're great.
I love documentary filmmakers. Yeah. Okay. Remind me, that Wednesday night, because I don't think we've talked about this before. I don't remember if we talked about this last
week. Okay.
We got to talk about The Shining. We got to talk about this found footage.
Yeah, we do. We haven't mentioned that at all, and I remember you posted something about that. So, yeah, we'll definitely talk about that Wednesday night.
Oh, my God.
It's amazing. We start doing this series, and all this found footage starts showing up.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I've reached out to the theater and tried to ask them, where did you find the ending? They're all supposed to be confiscated and destroyed.
Right. No, it's this.
So,
wow.
Haven't heard anything back, but and I probably won't. But,
right.
And also, I mean, Stephen King's writing a sequel to The Shining now.
Now that I did not. Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's some Shining news. So let's.
When did he say? He's really writing a sequel?
I'll find out more information on it, but yeah, he is. He's spoken about it, and he's so Wednesday night, I'm pretty sure we'll be back with Michael Berryman, and we'll go through some Shining news then.
All right, sounds good, yeah.
Okay, movie theme. What should I end with? We have...
Nothing from the Planet of the Apes, but...
we have Buckaroo Banzai.
Mm-hmm.
We have Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. We have Dune, The Illustrated Man. We have Knight Rider.
you really want to play Knight Rider. You really
no,
want
I don't. No, I don't.
Let's do Dune.
Well, we also have Warrior.
Let's do Warrior because it's timely, I guess. So.
That's what we discussed that somewhat tonight.
Yeah.
We'll close with Mark Isham's Warrior.
Sounds good.
All right. And I'll see you back Wednesday, dude.
Wednesday. All right. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Dean, for calling in.
Thank you, man.
All right.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.